Good evening. It is Thursday, February 6th, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. There's an update in the Iowa caucus. Top Democratic official calls for redo as Buttigieg and Sanders are still in a very tight race. It seems as though the technical difficulties that have plagued the vote counting in the Iowa caucuses, which took place on Monday, will now have to be recounted. Tom Perez says that enough is enough. And with that, we turn now to a related story. Yesterday, the Gray Zone founder Max Blumenthal reported that behind the app that delayed Iowa's voting results is a dark money operation funded by anti-Bernie Sanders billionaires. Its top donor, Seth Klarman, is a Buttigieg backer who has dumped money into pro-settler Israeli lobby groups. Journalist Lee Fang reported that a previously unknown tech outfit called Shadow Inc. had contracted with the Iowa Democratic Party to create the failed technology. The firm was comprised of former staffers for Obama and Clinton, as well as the tech industry, and had paid for software rights by the Buttigieg campaign. What does all of this mean and why does it matter? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guest. He's an award-winning journalist and author of several books, including the best-selling Republican Gomorrah and several documentaries, including Killing Gaza. He's the founder of The Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal. Max, welcome back.
Good to be back.
We're also joined by a web developer and technologist, Chris Garafa. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. Great to talk to both of you.
So, Max, looking at what you published yesterday and now today, the force accused of sowing the confusion and disarray surrounding the first Democratic Party contest of the 2020 election comes from a dark money nonprofit called Acronym. An acronym launched Shadow Inc. You've been on this case longer than you realized.
Yeah. I mean, once I had a few hours to look into the political network behind this 33-year-old consultant, political operative who is really credited with the entire Iowa fiasco, Tara McGowan, who spun out the Shadow Incorporated app out of her dark money group, Acronym, I realized that we've been covering this network at the Gray Zone for some time. We first ran a series of stories in 2018 about a disinformation operation run by another kind of technology cybersecurity firm called New Knowledge, where a bunch of disinformation artists went down to Alabama to win the special Senate election in 2017 for Doug Jones. And what they did was set up fake Facebook pages to draw Republican voters away from his opponent, Roy Moore, and pump up a dark horse, unknown Republican write-in candidate to get Republicans basically to vote for the write-in candidate. Then they purchased bots from Russia with Cyrillic names for Roy Moore's Twitter account and then launched a story nationally that Roy Moore was being supported by Russia. This is all done secretly, a disinformation campaign which its own architects called Project Birmingham, and they called it a false flag operation in their own secret internal documents, which were later leaked to the New York Times, and we reported on it. And the key link here is that this entire disinformation operation was funded by a Silicon Valley billionaire named Reid Hoffman, who's the founder of LinkedIn, who is also the funder of Tara McGowan's career and put the seed money forward to start Acronym. And what Tara McGowan is doing around the country and races around the country is using disinformation tactics, which we can get into later. But the overall point is, when you step away and look at Iowa, they're saying it's a mistake. They're saying it's the product of just a malfunction. But you have all of these disinformation artists involved who are clearly aligned with Pete Buttigieg. In fact, Tara McGowan is married to the senior advisor to Pete Buttigieg. She was having dinner with the Democratic chair in Iowa, Troy Price, the night before the election. They're all in the tank for Buttigieg. When you step away and look at this trail of disinformation tactics, you have to start asking if something more sinister is at play.
And Chris Garofa, as a technologist, and, you know, we had Hillary Clinton telling us that the Russians had hacked into her server and that the Russians were stealing all these emails. And then we've got the Russians that are buying up all this Facebook time and they have infiltrated our election. And, hey, it doesn't seem to be that you got to go to Russia in order to find election tampering here.
Yeah, I can't wait to see who's going to claim that it was Russia that that broke this app that Shadow made. I mean, it's a joke, but it's certainly possible that we're going to see some Democratic Party operatives try to claim that. They can't get off this idea that it's all Russia, that there's no illicit activity in elections here. I mean, I think we need to talk about what happened with this app specifically. Now, we don't know a lot about the app itself and what platforms it runs, but from my perspective, in my experience having managed and developed software, I think, frankly, that Shadow, it seems like they put this together at the last minute. And they reportedly used two very new people in the, very new coders to do this and did not provide them the support that they needed to write an app that could handle something at this scale. So, we don't know. Was the app changing numbers? Was it just a technical failure? We don't know at this point, but the reporting that Max and others have been doing really tells us a lot about what is behind this app and Shadow and Acronym, which has, of course, its PAC as well, Pacronym. So, there were folks working on taking this app apart and looking through it. Some of that work is happening in Dallas as we speak, and we'll certainly be following that as we get more information from them. But I do want to be cautious about saying that it was the app changing numbers. I think the bigger picture, rather than that conspiracy, the bigger picture is looking at who's behind this app, where the money came from, it doing exactly as Max has been wonderfully doing.
So, Max, now Tom Perez is saying that he's calling on the Iowa Democratic Party to immediately begin a re-canvass. Based upon what you've uncovered through your investigation and how you understand this is operating, does the re-canvass just wind up sending the same information through the same bad calculus? Or, I guess that takes me back to what Chris is touching on. Is this a mistake? Or, as you said, when you take a step back and you look in and you look at who's involved, this can't be just a coincidence.
No, this is not a mistake. When Bernie Sanders declares victory and it's obvious that they're holding back the remaining, 28% of precincts or 40%, I don't know, they started with 62% and it just stopped there. Mm-hmm. They held off at all the precincts in Des Moines and in the college towns where Bernie Sanders was drawing all his strength, and Bernie Sanders was still ahead in votes, then Bernie Sanders declares victory, and Tom Perez, who is installed through a dirty tricks campaign run by Barack Obama to destroy Keith Ellison, because the party openly came out and said, if you put Keith Ellison in there at the head of the DNC, you're handing the party to Bernie Sanders. When all of these pieces are in play, it's not a mistake anymore. Tom Perez is trying openly to sabotage Bernie Sanders. And, there's another important piece on our site, thegrayzone.com, by Kevin Gostola, who I think has been a guest on your show before,
yes,
who analyzed all of the characters that Tom Perez put forward for the DNC platform committee. And they're all Hillary Clinton retreads, corporate Democratic operatives, Israel lobbyists, people who would do everything, who would give their lives to stop Bernie Sanders from being the nominee. You even have someone who's on the board of Democratic Majority for Israel, Israel lobby group, which has taken out hundreds of thousands of dollars of ads to attack Bernie Sanders, is unelectable. So just put the pieces together. We're witnessing a coup in real time against the presumptive nominee, not just in Iowa, but of the Democratic Party itself. Even 538, the kind of mainstream Democratic poll, has predicted Bernie Sanders is the front runner in virtually every state in Super Tuesday. So they're just throwing every kind of dirty trick they can at him. I don't think they have a very good game plan, but you know, they're just trying to muck up the works as much as possible. And what needs to happen if Tom Perez initiates a revote is Bernie Sanders needs to send his troops out to Iowa and protest this because he won. It's very clear.
Chris Garofa, can you, in a very, very simplistic way, kind of explain to my audience why these Facebook bots and trolls and how this is really having a substantive impact on outcome? Because old folks like me who don't really pay it, who, yes, do use Facebook, but don't use it to the degree that my 17-year-old son does, may not understand how powerful programs such as Project Birmingham can be on an outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And first, we need to look at the fact that people, majority of people at this point, get a lot of their news from social media. Facebook creates a bubble for us in terms of what it shows us. Twitter, if you look at Twitter, you'll always see on the side of the app, in the app, you'll see trends. And the bot makers have gotten extremely good at identifying how to get something trending or how to insert themselves and use the trending hashtags or topics to get their content visible to the most amount of people. So in some cases, these accounts are created on the spot. In many cases, though, there is a network of accounts ready to go that has already existed, and they'll clear out all of the old posts from those accounts and, you know, rebrand them, so to say, to look like they want, you know, the people that they want it to be looking like it's real people. All of it is to say that these bot networks are effectively trying to push the conversation one way or another. And the more money you have, the more of these accounts you can control, the more influence you're able to have in the online conversation that really impacts so much of what we think about news and politics in this 24-hour immediate result news cycle.
So, Max, what do you now want? What should the readers of yesterday's piece and today's piece, what's most alarming to you in all of this?
That the people behind this Iowa fiasco are disinformation artists, and they almost openly say so, and that what we're going to be subjected to, whether we like it or not as citizens, are online disinformation campaigns that are being basically validated by Facebook and other social media platforms at a time when they're censoring alternative media. So Tara McGowan, she's running a massive multi-million-dollar, $25 million fake news operation on Facebook called Courier Newsroom. She's working with people from Harvard, from Vice Media. And what they do is they are opening, and there are Republicans doing this as well, so it's not just on the Democratic side. They open community pages or local newspapers, what seem like local newspapers, like the Virginia Dogwood. She paid in 2018 $275,000 to promote the Virginia Dogwood on Facebook. She draws in people across political lines with local stories, and then as Election Day gets closer, they start pumping them with political messaging that persuades them to vote for their candidate. This is the same thing that the Internet Research Agency in Russia, this troll farm that the Senate investigated, is accused of doing. And in fact, the political strategist behind this whole operation that Reid Hoffman, the billionaire I mentioned before, is funding, has said that the Internet Research Agency is a model for what they're doing. So they're doing this in our politics. It's not Russia. These are just homegrown disinformation artists to deceive all of us. And it's actually something that I've seen in my coverage in Latin America. For example, when I was covering the coup in Nicaragua in 2018 and interacting with people across the country, they would show me these Facebook sites, which would draw them in with gossip, Facebook community pages. And then as the coup erupted, the pages would start bombarding them with anti-Sandinista information. Daniel Ortega is killing us. Get out in the streets. So these are disinformation tactics that are being just exported abroad, and they're being brought home in a very insidious way. And meanwhile, this same person is responsible for the app that sabotaged the Iowa caucuses. I just can't believe it. I have to like step back from my own articles and wonder if it's true, because we're just living in such a surreal reality.
Well, Max, let me say, your reporting is pretty thorough, so when you step back and question yourself, trust me, you're doing good work.
Thanks.
Chris Garaffa, one of the things that now this same software app that was used in Iowa was going to be used in Nevada. Nevada has now said they're not going to use it. But now the folks in New Hampshire are saying we won't have the same problem in New Hampshire because we have a government agency of vote counters that does nothing but count votes. And so they say we're not going to have the same problems that they have in Iowa because we're professionals and we do this a whole nother way. As a technologist, do you have any confidence in what the folks in New Hampshire are saying?
No, I don't. I'm very happy that Nevada is not going to be using this app, but there's a larger question when it comes to the use of technology in elections. We need to have federally mandated, open source, verifiable election systems, not apps and machines made by private companies that have no accountability to the rest of us. This has been something that has been going on for decades when there are private companies making these machines, making these apps, and state by state, even county by county or city by city, you can use a different machine on the same day to vote in elections. Now, we need that for federal elections. We need it for state and local elections. There needs to be a federal guideline and federal standards for this. The other thing, like I said, we need open source election systems so that technologists, programmers, security analysts can go in and actually look at the code and look at the hardware and say, hey, there's a problem with this. It needs to be fixed, rather than relying, again, on private, non-accountable organizations to run our elections, whether that's in the DNC itself or the RNC or in general elections. That needs to be across the board.
Max, this is, I think, kind of rhetorical, but do you expect the details that you've laid out very clearly and the dots that you've connected? This is like 6 degrees of separation, and how close are we to Kevin Bacon? Do you expect the mainstream media to start calling out the names of Reid Hoffman and Project Birmingham and Tara McGowan? Do you expect to hear Rachel Maddow talk about this tonight?
Well, you know, we're definitely hearing a lot about Tara McGowan because I think even Democratic Party elites are upset at what she's done, at least some of them. And we did see some anger from Wolf Blitzer and other kind of more senior figures, because what we're seeing is kind of a takeover of the Democratic Party apparatus by a new network of these 30 and 40 something tech-centric hucksters backed by the Silicon Valley billionaires. And, you know, a lot of traditional Democrats aren't entirely comfortable with it. And these include people like Bernie Sanders. But at the same time, what I think we're seeing or not seeing from MSNBC, and it particularly MSNBC, is actual investigative reporting, or the New York Times is actual investigative reporting on the sinister quality. You know, and I'm drawing from a lot of mainstream sources, but what the media isn't doing is putting the pieces
together. They're not connecting the dots.
Showing this as a whole, exactly. And that's kind of what I see my job as, because when you step back and look at the dots connected, there's no way not to see this in a more sinister light.
See, now, because I heard Wolf and I heard others mention Shadow Inc. and talk about the atrocious app, but I didn't hear them go any further than mentioning Shadow Inc. That was my point.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at a political article yesterday and it said Reid Hoffman is close to Tara McGowan. But, you know, put the pieces together. What is Reid Hoffman doing around the country? He and his strategist, Dimitri Melhorn, were investigated by Facebook for violating community standards for setting up fake news pages like the kind I just mentioned. You know, they obviously have a mode of operation that is deeply undemocratic. And here they are at the middle of the Iowa fiasco.
So, Chris Garaffa, as a technologist, if I were to try to defend Shadow Inc.'s app and I were to say, well, apps fail all the time, that, you know, this was not nefarious. This was just what happens when you launch a new app quickly and you don't have the opportunity to do all of the beta testing that you would normally do. This is what happens. What would you say as a technologist to that defense?
I would say that, yes, there is some truth to that. That is a reality of the technology world. But I think we need to be looking at where the money is. Why did they bring in this new company, this brand new company, with all of these shady characters behind it? With, you know, where is the money coming from? What was the purpose? So, yes, is it possible? Certainly is. In my experience, I've had things break like this. But there's a lot more to this story, as we've been talking about. We need to look at why Reid Hoffman and so many others have been involved and where this money is coming from, where the direction to do it at the last minute seemingly came from.
Well, Chris Garofa, I know the answer to that. The answer to that is ask Max Blumenthal, because he wrote the piece. Max did the homework. Max knows the answer.
Exactly. So I'm very glad we're talking to Max here.
Well, I'm not the oracle here. I'm just putting basic pieces together, and I think there are plenty of other people out there who can do the same, but it's really to look, you really have to just look to alternative media at this point. I think that's the answer.
And so this brings us full circle. The deeply undemocratic campaign Project Birmingham was overseen, and Max, this is your reporting, by a cast of characters remarkably similar to those who bungled the 2020 Iowa caucus account. According to you, Max, 30 and 40-something techies who had worked in the Obama administration on various Democratic campaigns are at the crux of this big problem.
Yep. And, you know, whether you look at New Knowledge, the firm that ran the disinformation campaign in Alabama, which deceived voters deliberately and attempted to convince the American public that the Kremlin was interfering in the election, just straight up lying to stir fears of Russian interference. You look at the staff of that firm that was paid by Reid Hoffman, Obama administration veterans who also worked in the national security state, 30 and 40 somethings. Then you look at the staff of Acronym, or the CEO, Tara McGowan, 33 years old, veteran of Obama for America 2008 and 2012, married to a senior advisor to Pete Buttigieg. Dimitri Melhorn, chief strategist overseeing all of these disinformation campaigns. He is of the same generation, maybe a little older, but someone who went to the Harvard Kennedy School, which Pete Buttigieg went to. Someone who launched his career in McKinsey, which where Pete Buttigieg launched his career. They're all of the same kind of cultural niche, and they don't play by Democratic small d rules, as we're seeing in Iowa. These are the same people who spun out the kind of Russiagate hysteria, and they're doing exactly what they accused the Kremlin of doing in our democracy.
And final question for you. The one name you didn't mention here that you mentioned in your article is Robbie Mook,
yep,
former Hillary Clinton campaign manager. How does he play into all this?
Well, that's a great question, and that's something that journalists should be looking at. This is someone who runs the Defending Digital Democracy Initiative, which supposedly came into Iowa and put all of the precinct chairs and the party chiefs on a kind of war footing, working with the chief of staff to Obama's Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter. And this whole outfit was spun out of Harvard's Belfer Center. We don't know exactly what he did. He was initially blamed for the faulty app, but clearly Robbie Mook and his team were down there. They were preparing all of these county chairs and precinct captains for foreign interference and worst-case scenarios. And the worst-case scenario turned out to be much worse than anyone could have imagined, because the caucus itself was completely destroyed internally. So we need to know, there should really be a federal investigation into what happened, and someone who would be called to testify would be Robbie Mook, because I don't accept the explanation that he was just simply involved in a sort of preliminary phase and didn't have any effect on the overall results. And actually, we're seeing a lot of spin from Harvard's Belfer Center today. They're releasing sort of press releases from Harvard trying to deny any role in this fiasco. So this is about our elites and the future generation of elites and people who are trying to take over one of the major two parties in the U.S. and how they are just absolutely destroying whatever's left of democracy from within. We need to know whether they're just bunglers or whether there's something more sinister at play.
And you mentioned the Kennedy School. I think candidate Deval Patrick was also there at the Kennedy School with these folks. So we don't know if
amazing. I hadn't thought of that. And, you know, how did Deval Patrick get votes in rural counties in Iowa? I mean, what is going on there?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, of course, we know he's very close to former President Barack Obama.
Yep.
Got to connect those dots. Hey, as always, Chris Garofa, Max Blumenthal, hey, thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciate this insight. And, man, you have really uncovered something here. Appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Wilmer.
All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Democrats at a crossroads after Trump's acquittal. Do they continue going down this rabbit hole, or do they shift into 2020 election mode and speak to the issues that matter to average Americans? To get an answer to this, we turn to my next guest. He's an American sociologist, specialist in comparative historical sociology, and professor at the University of Albany, SUNY. He's best known as the author of the book Capitalists in Spite of Themselves, which has been awarded several prizes, including the American Sociological Association Distinguished Scholarly Book Award. Richard Lachman, Dr. Lachman, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So yesterday, House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler suggested that it was a matter of time before the chamber would call Bolton. Quote, when you have a lawless president, you have to bring that to the fore. You have to spotlight that. You have to protect the Constitution, whatever the political consequences. That's just one example. I've got others which I'll get into. But at this point, how do you see the Democrats' conundrum here? Do they proceed down this path, or is it time to just lick your wounds and look at 2020?
Well, I mean, I think they can do both. That, you know, there is a real need to find out, you know, more precisely exactly what Trump's interaction with the Ukrainians was, and, you know, to get Bolton to testify makes sense. But, you know, that certainly can't be the focus of the Democratic presidential candidates. You know, they need to do two things. First of all, make clear what it is they do as president to draw a contrast with Trump. And also to, when they're criticizing Trump, it isn't a good idea for them mainly to keep hammering at what they've been telling everybody for the past 4 years, that Trump is corrupt, Trump's a racist. Instead, they need to focus on the things that he promised he'd do when he ran for president and hasn't even made any effort to deliver on. You know, one of his big promises was there'd be a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. He didn't even propose a bill. You know, this isn't a case where he proposed something and the Democrats in the House blocked it. He just didn't bother, and they could go down the list of one thing after another and say, you know, this isn't a serious man. The only thing that he put any effort into was this $1 trillion tax cut for the 1%. You know, that's what he really cared about, and that's what he got. And what he promised to everybody else isn't important to him, and it's not important to the Republicans in Congress, and they just didn't work on it at all.
Senator Robert Menendez seems to be a voice of reason here in following on. I guess this is a following to what you've just laid out. Quote, we also have to have our own idea and vision. We can't win the next election just being against Trump. We have to be for something. End quote. One of the big mistakes of many that I think Hillary made was she spent an inordinate amount of time telling people what was patently obvious, and that was that Trump was abhorrent. Instead of laying out policy initiatives that would improve the quality of life for the average American, and it seems it sounds as though you would support this, they're falling into the same trap, which makes me wonder: are they taking Trump's bait?
Well, I think some Democrats are and some aren't. That, you know, in the case of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, you know, they're not taking the bait. You know, both of them are proposing specific ideas of what they do as president. And, you know, they're certainly critical of Trump, but that's not their focus. So I think they're in somewhat different ways, both taking the right path, while the other Democrats, you know, mainly are talking about what's bad about Trump, and they present themselves and their qualities as just in opposition to Trump. You know, you should vote for me because I'm tolerant. You could vote for me because I'm really serious. Or you should vote for me because I know how to conduct foreign policy in a non-corrupt way. And that's not enough.
You mentioned Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, and it's interesting that you would bring those two up, especially Bernie, because I think you're absolutely right about them. But the irony there is the party really seems to be undermining Bernie. And so as Bernie has been trying to differentiate himself and outline very clear policy initiatives that would differentiate himself from President Trump, the party seems to be doing everything they can do to see to it that Bernie doesn't make any progress.
Oh, that's definitely the case. They're, you know, they don't want him to get the nomination. On some level, they'd rather lose than have Bernie become president. You know, they won't admit that openly, and, you know, they'll certainly, if Bernie gets the nomination, they'll say, oh, yes, we're voting for him, we support him, but, you know, they'll undermine him in all sorts of ways. You know, I mean, this, you know, it's, you know, the last true insurgent who got the Democratic nomination, the only one who did, was George McGovern. And, you know, a number of Democrats openly backed Nixon instead. You know, I don't think any of them will openly back Trump, but, you know, they'll undermine Sanders just as they undermine McGovern. And the big question, of course, would be is, you know, could Bernie do what he says he can do, which is to get all sorts of people who haven't voted in the past energized and out there to vote? I mean, if he can do that, he can win despite being undermined. But, you know, if he can't do that, then it would end up as a catastrophe.
As a sociologist, a historical sociologist, and author of the book Capitalists in Spite of Themselves, has this whole discussion about socialism and the president saying during the State of the Union, we will never allow socialists to take control of our government, and Bernie saying, well, I'm a democratic socialist, and trying to explain to the American people what that actually means, has that piqued your interest? And do you have any thoughts on this whole debate? And is it really a debate worth having?
I mean, I think it's, you know, in large part a matter of labels. That, you know, if you look at the substance of what Bernie's proposing, it's not particularly radical. You know, he's not proposing that we should nationalize banks, nationalize major industries. You know, what he's in favor is a big expansion in social benefits paid for by higher taxes on the rich. And, you know, probably the most socialist thing about him is that he really wants to encourage the re-strengthening of labor unions, you know, which you'd think any Democrat who has any political sense at all would be in favor of. But, you know, somehow none of the Democratic presidents from Carter on have done anything to help labor unions.
And so, where is the gap? Well, because you have those that will say that this is really, in terms of the Democratic Party, that this is an intra-party fight between the elite establishment class of the party versus the base of the party, which Bernie is trying to appeal to, that the elites in the class have more in common with the Republicans than they have with the average American, and that they're basically trying to hold on to what they have. Do you see that as being a valid distinction?
Yes, I do. You know, I think the elite in the, I mean, they don't really have very, very much in common with Trump, but they, you know, certainly have things in common with the way Republicans were 10 or 20 years ago. And you especially hear that with Biden. Oh, I was friendly with this senator and that, and if I become president, we can cooperate again. So, you know, he's, you know, certainly identifying himself with certain sorts of Republicans. And, you know, when he says that, you can hear, you know, much more sincerity and emotion in that than, you know, with his line, oh, I'm working class Joe. I like unions. I mean, that's, you know, just words. And, you know, there isn't really much feeling behind it at all. And I think, you know, in that he's really expressing who he is. You know, he's, so it is a problem for the Democrats. You know, they've for decades now have been in favor of big tax cuts. You know, they've imagined that dangling money in front of, you know, high-tech entrepreneurs is the key to economic well-being for everybody in the country. And, you know, that hasn't worked economically, and that most people's standard of living has been stagnant now for decades. And it also hasn't worked politically. You know, the Democratic Party is the minority party. They lose more elections than they win. So, you know, these supposed political experts aren't such experts. You know, they don't know how to win elections.
And if my numbers are right, there are more Democrats in, or at least there were up until about 3 years ago. There were, now because the independent classification has grown dramatically, there were more Democrats in the country than Republicans. And
oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, if you ask people on the issues what they think, you know, big majorities of Americans, you know, favor Democratic and not Republican positions, and majorities favor Bernie Sanders type positions. You know, if you left out the candidates and, you know, you asked people, you know,
right,
just on a number of issues and you got a platform, it would be the Sanders platform.
And very good proof of that is when you asked people about the Affordable Care Act, people love the Affordable Care Act, but they hate Obamacare.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and it's nothing, you know, back when Bill Clinton was first president and he tried to get a health care plan through, you know, very quickly, most people were against it. But, you know, then the pollsters said, well, you know, what sort of plan do you want? And, you know, the end result was, you know, this is wonderful headline. You know, it's the Clinton plan they want, but they don't know it.
Exactly. Getting back to your point that the Democrats could do both in terms of pursue Trump and look forward to the 2020 election. In listening to you and in thinking about what you've just said, I would be more inclined to agree with you if the Democrats were effective at messaging and being able to explain to the American people what it is that they're doing and trying to do. But their lack of focus and lack of message. And then when you have Democrats such as Representative Al Green in December saying that the House is open to bringing additional articles of impeachment against the president if the Senate acquitted him, and then yesterday saying that he hasn't wavered and that the House stands by ready to bring more charges if the president commits additional impeachable acts or potentially for acts he has already committed, that's telling me they're not learning. And that tells me that, so I say again, if there were a message on the other side of that, that was explaining to the American people, this is what we're going to do, this is what we're about, this is why we're here, and we're still going to do what we feel we need to do, blah, 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 as Representative Al Green said, I'm with you. But I don't hear that other message.
I know. I mean, partly it's, especially in the House, you know, it's a fairly diverse party. You have some representatives who come from districts that are overwhelmingly Democratic and mm-hmm. whose constituents, you know, really hate Trump and want to hear aggressive action against Trump. So, you know, within their single districts, you know, saying we're going to impeach him again makes a certain political sense. But if they want to be a national party, if they want to capture the presidency, you know, those sorts of voices need to, you know, be less prominent. And instead, we need to hear about issues that Americans care about, saying, you care about healthcare, this is what we're going to do, and this is what Trump didn't do. You know, you care about infrastructure, this is what we're going to do, this is what Trump didn't do, and go through the issues one after another in that way.
We had a reporter in Iowa, and he was reporting that impeachment was not on the list of things that are important as he went through the Iowa caucuses, that Bob Schlehuber was saying, impeachment's not on their list. These people aren't interested. They want to know about jobs. They want to know about infrastructure. They want to know about their grain silos that are full of soybeans that are not being sold to the Chinese. That's the things that, or those are the things that matter to them, not impeachment.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Well, we will see how this whole thing plays out. Unfortunately, again, if you listen to Representative Al Green, if you listen to Representative from Illinois, Raj Krishnamoorthy, on the Oversight and Intelligence Committees, they seem to be going full steam ahead on this. And we'll have, you know, it'll be interesting to see how much of this is just bluster versus how much of this has any real substance behind this as we move further and further away from yesterday's vote. Dr. Richard Lachman, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
It was great to talk with you and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Huawei sues Verizon over patents. Verizon blasts this suit as a public relations stunt. China's biggest telecommunications equipment maker, Huawei, will square off in court against the number one U.S. wireless carrier over whether Verizon Communications, Inc. should pay Huawei Technologies for patent infringement. This I find incredibly ironic, since one of the biggest complaints that U.S. companies have against China is intellectual property infringement and reverse engineering. But what's at stake here? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the new book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. As always, Jack, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
And let me just say, for clarity's sake and for honesty, I retired from Verizon after 23 years as a senior contracts manager. And so, folks, just so you'll know, my employment there has nothing to do with this conversation, but I felt, for full disclosure, I needed to make that point. So, Jack, late yesterday, Huawei sued the U.S. in two district courts in Texas, alleging that Verizon used 12 Huawei patents without authorization in areas such as computer networking, download security, and video communications. Your thoughts on what this means, if anything?
Well, you know, you got to remember that virtually 90% of all the new technology patents in the world are being filed by China and the U.S., roughly about the same. Everyone else is far behind. So this is a tech war, as I've been saying, for quite some time. It was hidden behind the tariff war. Now it's out in the open, i.e. going after Huawei, which has been for some time now, and other Chinese corporations, and attempting to drive Chinese researchers out of the U.S. and cut off joint work between U.S. researchers and Chinese researchers. It's all about the tech war, which is escalating now. Patents, these are software patents. You got to remember that, Huawei's product line is both hardware, you know, routers, the physical equipment, mm-hmm. kind of like competes with Cisco routers and so forth. But it's proprietary software that's based on these routers. That's how these tech companies capture the market. They try to build proprietary hardware and software, so no one else really internetworks with them, and you got to buy their hardware and therefore their software. Well, it looks like Verizon is attempting to kind of grab some of the software, you know, the features, the functions on applications that are built on top of of you know, the core software that rides on the, this hardware. And as part of this trade war going on over Huawei, you know, the U.S. got Canada to arrest their co-chair there up in Canada, and is trying to extradite him to her to the U.S. So it's all about this tech war taking many, many different forms right now. And Huawei is striking back and saying, hey, you're stealing our software. Well, where is Verizon using this software if they don't have the Huawei hardware? Well, there's only really one other place in the world that makes the hardware and the software, proprietary again, and that's Ericsson and Nokia. In other words, in Europe, there's only really two players who make this stuff, and they're not American. Ah, so the U.S. has dropped the ball on 5G. Instead of AT&T and Cisco and the others really competing with Huawei and Ericsson, they've let them grab the market, and now the U.S. is trying to get it back. By the way, you know, the U.S. lacking a real 5G hardware product, what's it talking about? It just came out today, this is a little bit of an addendum here, that Attorney General Barr has suggested maybe the U.S. buy and take over controlling interest in Ericsson.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we don't have a product, so we're bullying our way into competition with Huawei.
But wait a minute, Jack, help me out, because during the football game, and we've talked about this before, during the Super Bowl, Verizon advertised that they installed their 5G technology at the Miami Stadium, and that they're also advertising that they have 5G in various cities around the country.
Well, this is either they're baiting, is a term, beta, using pilot programs. They're either baiting the Ericsson equipment, I'm not sure, or what they're doing is pumping up their 4G capacity so it's, you know, 5G light. There really is right. No true 5G having been employed or deployed here in the United States. It's a lot of marketing hype.
And by bumping up their 4G in that very confined space of a football stadium or in a city that where you will be able to have access for a mile or 2 miles, that's quite possible by putting enough hardware in that very limited space to do that. But that is not giving you the Internet of Things. That's not giving you the ability for driverless cars to communicate with each other and the other real benefits that 5G provides.
Right, right. It's a marketing play claiming they have 5G that's a little faster than 4G because of the way they tweak the network, you see.
Yeah, the bandwidth that they are able to provide, again, in that limited space, gives those users in that space a feel of 5G, but it's not 5G.
A feel is a good way to express it. Yeah, it's not really 5G. You see, 5G is very important for military technology of the next generation. Artificial intelligence is about massive databases and massive application and access of databases and doing very high-level statistical operations on that database. And you can't have true AI without 5G, you see.
Right.
And what's the main applications for 5G plus AI militarily? Well, it's controlling these hypersonic missiles. Mm-hmm. It's controlling roving nuclear-powered torpedoes that'll just, you know, run around the oceans wherever they want them. And it's for being able to manage human-machine interaction in battlefield contexts. That's the military application of AI, massive information necessary for all that. But you need the 5G, the big pipe, to be able to control the massive information. So that's why the U.S. is going after Huawei, which has the lead now in 5G, although the U.S. probably has a lead in AI. So it's part of this tech war. And you got the other little third player out there called Ericsson.
One of the other things that I wanted to touch on here is that also one of Huawei's complaints is that Verizon is providing access – to infringing technologies that use Huawei patented technology, Cisco, Nexus, Catalyst, some of the other major players here, which are attached to the Verizon network. So Huawei has cast a pretty big net here.
Yeah, well, you know, what the U.S. is trying to do, because it doesn't really have a competitive product, is to leapfrog the hardware-software solution for 5G, which is, Huawei and Ericsson, and to develop what's called a virtual network, so pure software-based solution to this. Well, you know, it's kind of dragging or stealing some of Huawei software, probably, in this process of trying to develop a pure software virtual network 5G solution. That's just getting off the ground, but the U.S. Is just passing a law and is funding this whole new network virtualization 5G approach, next generation 5G, all software-based. So, you know, it's co-opting and, here and there where it can, it's copying some of the software probably that Huawei has.
You, switching gears here a bit, you did an analysis of the State of the Union address from Tuesday, and you entitled it Trump's Red Meat State of the Union Speech, U.S. Political Crisis Now Deepens. Talk a bit about what you heard from the president, because he didn't really spend a whole lot of time. You and I were talking off mic. He kind of glossed over this 5G China issue.
Yeah, because, what he's doing now is trying to open the tech war here directly, not under the cover of tariffs in the so-called phase two. He didn't talk about that much. In fact, he didn't talk about the whole China-U.S. mini trade deal hardly at all, or talk about, aside from just mentioning it, the NAFTA 2.0. Because if you look at those deals, there's no there. You know, these are really lightweight deals, and I guess he didn't want to go and talk about it in detail. But it was noticeable.
But wait a minute, Jack. Nancy, today during her press conference, Nancy Pelosi touted the NAFTA 2.0 as a Democratic win, saying that what we actually accomplished here, you know, is very valuable to the United States, and the president is touting it as his. But what he proposed is not what we wound up giving back to him. So this is really a Democratic victory. She was touting that NAFTA 2.0 as a Democratic accomplishment.
Right. She's touting it because what she did and the Democrats did was join Trump in supporting the NAFTA 2.0. And what the Democrats did was get these very token changes to the old NAFTA, supposedly changes that would reduce a little bit of the pharma ripoff, pharma prices, you know, big pharma drug prices. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, there's a provision in there where the Democrats claim they were able to get some real labor protections in that bill, which is just a lie. It's nonsense. It has all to do about inspectors. You know, originally the proposal was to have labor inspectors in Mexican factories, NAFTA inspectors, to see that, they weren't abusing their workers. You know, the conditions in Mexico factories is quite poor, you might say, even worse than the U.S. Well, those labor inspectors, Mexico said, no, we're not letting your labor inspectors into our factories. And they compromised on this phony deal where you would have a
commission
panel.
A panel, right?
A panel, mm-hmm. Made up of managers, right, both the U.S. and Mexico, to determine whether there was going to be an inspector, and only after the panel agreed to it would an inspector go in and look at the Mexican factories. So that's phony.
Gotcha.
But the point is that, Pelosi and the Democrats threw their hat in the ring supporting NAFTA. So they're trying to make it look like, it's a good deal, that what they did, they really improved it, which is just nonsense.
How did Trump, with his State of the Union, throw red meat to his base?
Well, if you really watch the presentation and listen to it all, what he really did was immigrants, right? Mm-hmm. A whole host of proposals, but the immigrants were the big problem. Once again, the immigrants were the killers, the criminals, And by immigrants, he means from south of the border, Latin, Latinos, mm-hmm. right? That's mm-hmm. what he means. And, you know, he proposed, new legislation, not only for the wall, but for going after sanctuary cities and allowing individuals to sue sanctuary cities and mobilizing, pumping up his, roiling his base to protest these sanctuary cities. In other words, targeting California, which is a sanctuary state. So he's really pumping up his troops and proposing new legislation. And, all our problems are the, the immigrants. But what's really was interesting, I thought, was the way he's trying to split the Democrat typical minority vote by splitting off African-Americans from the Democratic Party. And a number of all his gallery melodrama, I call them, examples, right, pointing to people in the gallery and so forth, were virtually all aimed at African-Americans.
Right.
And that played into his unprecedented ad during the Super Bowl as well. He's really going after African-Americans, and he's going to try to split the minority vote, I believe, because he's in trouble with white women in the swing marginal districts, and he's going to try to offset, by splitting the black vote. And in states, like Georgia, a big black turnout there, African-American turnout, that almost turned the state. So he's kind of worried, I think, on a couple of states, and he's appealing to the African-American vote. Apart from that, it was, other, gun rights. Not a word said about all the school shootings and the fact that you almost have one-a-day shootings in the high schools now. Nothing, prayer in schools. He's going to fund more prayer in schools. All the typical red meat. It wasn't a State of the Union presentation, which is usually about, what I've done and where we're going to go. Very clearly, where he's going to go is he's doubling down and he's agitating his base. And this war with the Democrats, this political war, is going to intensify now. And that's what his speech was. It was throwing all these ideas and proposals out to his base to mobilize him, to agitate him, to get ready to really go head-to-head with the Democrats in new ways, I suspect. Not your typical polite electioneering. This is going to be a real dirty, nasty thing in the next 8 months.
I got to stop you there. Dr. Jack Rasmus, Trump's Red Meat State of the Union speech. You can find it at ZNet, Trump's Red Meat State of the Union speech. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, sir, thank you so much for your time. All right, folks, you have been tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.